Showtime. All right, well, I just started, so I'll start now. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne, and with me as always is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
So we are here today with two special guests to talk a little bit about some of the research that we do and to actually have someone listen to a presentation we gave at a conference.
Yes.
So our two guests today, and we're going to let them introduce themselves respectfully, Andrew Tagg and Adam Ray. Whoever wants to go first, we like to let our guests introduce themselves because we're probably much worse at it than you are.
Well, since you said respectively and then put my name first, I'll go ahead. My name is Andrew Tagg. I'm a graduate student at Texas A&M Commerce, and my part for this presentation was talking about what it's like to work at a convention and how research being conducted on the grounds kind of changes things, and the best way for researchers to really navigate those fields and kind of what to expect.
It's also notable that this is Andrew's second time on the podcast. He came on a couple months ago to talk about math and video games.
Yeah.
So welcome back.
Would love to do a follow-up someday.
That I think is very doable.
Oh, yeah. We're doing cognition next.
Sweet.
Sounds interesting. Howdy, y'all. My name's Adam. I'm also a grad student at A&M Commerce, and I am what's called a generalist. I'm doing the ugly portion of the when you go to a convention and get surveys done.
So I guess just to set up the background, we originally proposed this thing pre-pandemic. Then the pandemic happened and the conference didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so then they allowed us to give the presentation again this year, which I think it's sitting at zero views on the conference YouTube channel, which is not necessarily all that surprising when you're turning everything into a bunch of private YouTube links.
And then not making a clear pathway to get to said private links.
It's a learning experience for, I think, everyone involved with this. But so we decided we wanted to get together now that we're done season two. We're kind of moving into this intermission, this flex session, to talk about a number of different things. But we figured, hey, we did a little bit into what is psychology. Why don't we go a little further and kind of talk a little bit about the research that we do? I guess we can almost say is kind of like a quasi-atypical nature of the research that we do, because a lot of research in psychology nowadays, and this is changing to a degree, is still predominantly in the classroom. It's predominantly with undergraduate students. They represent what we call a weird population. They're Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. But whenever I say this to my students, I always chuckle at the rich part.
Yeah.
Because I guess comparatively speaking, yes, average
income. It's all about perspective.
Right. But the idea is that, you know, if you're in this kind of weird group, if we're only researching people within these groups, we're losing the Eastern perspective on that side, or we're losing the non-Western perspective. We're looking at predominantly educated individuals or students who are kind of seeking higher education. I would kind of argue that it's probably a little more flexible nowadays because most people are expected to go to college. Maybe it depends on the college, but it's probably far more true if we're talking about the research that's going on in like an R1 institution. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be very different than the average student, I would argue, that's going to be going to like a community college, or that's going to be going to, you know, R2 or an R3. And then industrialized, higher income, I mean, colleges. I don't want to say college is not more affordable than it used to be.
No.
But it's easier to get a loan to go to college, so yes. Maybe that's
I was about to say, it's easier to mortgage your future.
Right.
So, God, I'm going to be cynical today.
This is our podcast. It's everything cynical.
Should have heard us last week. So... yeah, so this idea is that there is a specific type of person who goes to college versus who doesn't, and if they're making up the predominant number of psychological studies, we're either losing out on some of the groups that we want to look at, or we are not truly getting a representative sample.
Right. It really hurts generalizability when the majority of the population is not going to an R1 institution.
Right. Right. And I mean, that's a huge difference too, because the biggest publications, the one with the most funding, they're going to be at the big, whatever, the big, you know, 20 or so colleges around the country that are most well known for their psychology programs, or they're going to be at the one big program in the country. And so what that's ultimately going to lead to is a very biased sample, a very predominantly upper class or middle to upper class, predominantly white, predominantly, I would say Eurocentric, but American-centric.
Sample. It brings in, like, I just had a thought that was humorous to my head, was the Stanford Prison Experiment was a bunch of middle-class boomer men duking it out in the basement.
Right. And, yeah, and it really hasn't, I mean, it has changed a bit. I mean, there are far more women going to college than men. We actually see in our samples, it's what, 70%? Female on an average.
Well, that's the psychology sample bias as well, as most psychology students are female. So if we could spread out to other areas of research, like engineers, we'd probably get more males.
That's but true. That's if we just expanded beyond the psychology pool to the university in general, it would become more representative.
Right. And likely get more representation in terms of not just gender differences, but also ethnic background, socioeconomic status. I mean, there are some fields I would argue you're probably more likely to go into if you have a little bit of a buffer to start with, or that you might feel a little more comfortable choosing as sort of a path or an option in life. Maybe psychology's not one of them. I don't know.
I mean, everybody starts here, but they leave quick. They're like, wait, I have to take stats?
God, I went into psychology trying to get away from stats, and now I teach it on occasion.
Yeah. It's like, wait, we actually do science. Okay. I think I missed the stop for anthropology.
To be fair, just about every field of study requires math at some point. Like, even philosophy, which people don't think about math, a lot of, like, the foundational stuff for some of these guys is all, like, mathematical equations or logics. So it doesn't matter where you go, you're going to run into math.
There's no escape.
So I guess, you know, part of what we do, part of what we try to do in some of our research, and we're not perfect with it because we're still doing research at universities. Mm-hmm. A lot of our groups that we do go and look at are probably very, not even probably, they are weird in terms of the Western educated, industrialized, and so on. But we do a lot of research with fan communities, a lot of online research, trying to build a more, or a broader sample than a bunch of college students. Unfortunately, if you go to Reddit, you're probably still dealing with a bunch of college students. And if you go to some of these fan conventions, there's probably a pretty healthy overlap. What we are avoiding, at least in this case, is that we're trying to
at least leave the university.
Right.
But even, like, and I think this is something that kind of taps onto our conversation last week about intersectionality, like, I don't know if a sample that is fully diverse is by nature a virtue. Because I think in terms of, like, my sex research, where, like, I specifically say, this is with straight dudes.
Right.
Rather than, like, say, your 1960s, 70s research that was like, human sexuality is like this. Oh, by the way, we only studied straight dudes. So, like, when we do fan research, we are centering who the person is. In the study, we're not making a grand statement about, you know, psychology in general. So I don't know if they'd have to be diverse fan communities for us to be moving away from kind of this default positioning with sampling that psychology has a problem with.
Well, that kind of is something that I've also thought about on occasion is like the weird thing is only a problem because people want to conduct a study and say this is representative of all people. If we were to say this is representative of weird, we'd be perfectly fine. But the goal of psychology, you know, I would argue, is to have a more representative kind of a catalog or understanding of human experience and thought, not so much just weird. And I think that's where the problem is. Not so much that we're conducting all these studies, but that we can't use it to just say everyone's like this.
I mean, there are, there are certain studies that you could do to gather information about different types of communities, like say studying the homeless. That would be probably not weird. It would be primarily veterans and those with severe mental illnesses. So that could be another issue, though, is that it's still
very
tightly focused on just a certain community.
Weird is not bad. We're not necessarily bad. It can be if we're restricting that generalizability. But if I go to a group of anime fans and I collect a bunch of data from, let's say, 2,000 anime fans at a convention, what I might end up with is a representative sample of that group. But if I can show within that group that the same thing is happening with that college sample, and then there's other research that shows that the same thing is happening with this other sample, right, this other sample, that helps to build that kind of generalizability to say, like, yeah, these are processes that everyone experiences, that everyone engages with. And especially as social identity researchers, go to a group of highly identified fans, you get to see, you know, sort of these processes existing at kind of the most salient, most prime level when it comes to that.
Pure nerddom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so there's some good in it. There's some good at kind of moving outside of your comfort zone. And I would argue that part of the reason we don't do it as much is it's not easy.
No.
It is stressful. It is, I'm actually worried now that I've gotten an email because I went and posted something on Reddit today.
Uh-oh.
We have Reddit anxiety now.
Yeah, but see, I went, as we'll talk about the good. So I posted our 2021 Brony survey. So this is probably our 20-something survey over the last decade. And these are the kind of messages that I've been getting today. Field research is fantastic. Thank you for this.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Survey completed. Smiley face. Yeah. And that is typically not what you get when you submit to Reddit. It is.
I've been spoiled
in working with the Brony
community. Well, it's the Brony community, though. And the Brony community is very nice.
Be nice. That is part of the norms of their community.
Friendship is magic.
I mean, it's literally their tagline.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, so, yeah.
They're not.
I would be very concerned if a group of people who gathered around a show called with the line "Friendship is magic," if that was a cesspool, I would be very, very concerned.
I mean, there are some, but you get a large enough group of people, and there are definitely some, but they're not usually the ones who are like as closely tied. They're like the 4chan hold-ons. There's a toxic side of that community. But much like there's a toxic side to the furry community too, but the furry community fairly well rejects them.
Yeah, it's hard to like willingly let Nazi regalia into your convention.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but that is immediately what I thought about.
Yeah.
Though that needs to get put on the side. We definitely should come back to that and do an episode on toxic fan communities and how they play a role in that, because there's some stuff, and the Bronies are interesting because like it's one of the things that we've learned, like getting out of the classroom and then trying to look at these groups and how groups formed a fairly new fan community when it started. They're having to kind of now cope with maybe not being as hard as they should have been 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago to those elements of the community. There are some within that, you know, within the community, and they're kind of now just starting to like have that broader uncomfortable conversation, and it's not happy times for some people in the community.
Yeah, I've heard some conversations from some friends who are involved in the furry community, specifically some of the conventions. And those conversations have been very interesting.
But mostly positive. Mostly positive. I think that, you know, when it comes to fan research, the majority of the positive experiences that we have come from the in-person.
Yes.
So kind of starting there, I very rarely have I come across anything that I did not like at an in-person convention. Yeah. So typically with the in-person conventions, and I'll throw this to Andrew in just a second, but basically what we do is we set up a booth, we contact the convention ahead of time, we set up a booth, we print out, you know, an ungodly number of surveys and stuff them into folders, and then we sit there for, you know, sometimes 2 days, sometimes 5 days, handing out surveys and interacting directly with the community. It really helps if you print out your research papers and put those on the table so that way you can hand those out to people because they want to know what kind of research you're doing and how you're going to represent them in their community. But I think the biggest, you know, beyond just like physical exhaustion by the end of it, the biggest hurdle to getting into a fan conference to study a particular community is working with the community organizers to make sure that A, it's actually possible, and B, you get the best setup that you can. So Andrew has some experience with this from the other side of, you know, dealing with annoying researchers at his conventions. Can you kind of walk us through the best way to approach a convention and, you know, what convention organizers like to hear and like in their researchers?
All right. Yes, I can do that. And thank you for that transition. Well, I suppose start with, it's not my convention. I just help run it. And,
you take no responsibility for what goes on there.
Well, I wish I could say that. I'm as far as the fans conference, which is the conference in reference to my work, is the one that I work with. It's a academic convention, academic conference that operates in an anime convention, specifically ACON here in Texas. Been doing it for 7 or 8 years now, and I got started as a volunteer who was kind of being groomed to take on a role, a greater role than just volunteering and being you know, a foot soldier is how I usually think of it, with just your basic level volunteer, because you're generally not given a lot of decision making. That comes later. You're just following orders for the most part. But as I, you know, moved up through the ranks, as it were, I have had the opportunity to help make decisions as far as researchers and the facilitation of that. The first thing I would say, at least from the, if you're a researcher wanting to interact with a conference and do research there, my first piece of advice is thoroughly study the conference that you want to conduct research at. Now, a lot of what I'm going to say, I feel is going to be kind of obvious, but those are, sometimes in my experience, those are the obvious things are the most easily overlooked things. So know your convention. Like, and this is a big one that most people don't think about, is it nonprofit or for profit? Because those are two slightly different things as far as their legal standing, the responsibilities they have, to, you know, like, nonprofits tend to be purely fan run. So you're going to be interacting with different people than you would at, say, a convention being run for profit, which they're going to have more of a bottom line dollar sign kind of mentality as well. That being said, just because they're in it to make a profit doesn't mean they're not going to see the value in your research and what it can do for them. And that's kind of into my second point here. When you are talking to a convention, make sure that you are clear with not only how you are going to benefit or how science or how people are going to benefit, but how the convention itself is going to benefit and how the convention goers are going to benefit. That more than anything is going to at least open a door to a conversation for you, because I've never run across a convention runner who was not willing to do something if they honestly thought that their convention attendees would enjoy it. And I've seen some really interesting ideas greenlit, which were successful. Like, they knew what they were doing, but, you know, people might be surprised, you know, getting an idea floated and then having it accepted when it's kind of a crazy idea. So kind of tied up with those two points is, don't be afraid to ask. Know who you're asking questions of, if not necessarily the specific person, but kind of the mentality or personality of the convention. As well as, I guess that leads into my third point, which is, know exactly what you need. Have a really well thought out list of everything you need, because am I allowed to curse a little?
Yeah. Sure.
All right. There's nothing that pisses me off more than being told the day of, hey, I need a USB cable. If you want to see me flip a table, and Thomas has actually almost seen this happen once or twice when he was being a guest's handler. Conventions try to plan for everything, but they can't. So when you present them a problem they didn't know to anticipate, you're going to anger them. And that is going to make it a little more difficult to come back a second time, especially if they get reports from their attendees that you were obnoxious or something like that.
So you'd even argue that it's better for, let's say, a researcher going there to try to bring as much of their own stuff and to not have to bother the convention for anything. Like, if you can supply 99% of the stuff, the things that you need, you're probably a million light years ahead of anyone who's like, I'm going to need this, and I'm going to need this, and I might need this.
Mm-hmm. Right, but
the only thing we ask of the Furry Fiesta is space, tables, and chairs.
Yeah.
That's like the only, everything else we bring, and if we forget something, we get in the car and drive to Walmart.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, and this kind of feeds into the profit versus nonprofit thing, because you just listed the three most valuable things for a convention.
Yeah.
So it can be a little bit harder to get someone who has a dollar sign on that space, time, and access than it is to someone who's just like, oh, hey, we're just a group of people who got together and arranged this really cool event for our community. Mm-hmm. So that's, thank you for bringing that up, because that makes it a little bit easier to point out what I really meant by the profit versus nonprofit. I'm not going to say it's easier, but I think there are significantly less hurdles with a nonprofit than a for-profit sometimes. But, you know, Daniel, that is actually an interesting point, because it is a fine line to ask, because most conventions are more than happy to provide you with what you need, but you have to tell them. And sometimes bringing your own equipment can create problems for that convention if you don't know what the hell you're doing when you're hooking something up to a projector or whatever. Because we're in an anime convention, like, everything is like, let's show videos, let's show this, let's show that. So Akon is really good about having the equipment they need, but you can really tick off the sound department, and I've done this several times, they hated me one year, by trying to hook the stuff up by yourself. if you don't know what you're doing. If you know what you're doing, they don't care. They'll just be like, okay, you put it back to normal. We never even noticed. But it's an interesting line to tread there between, I would still say, like, I carry what I call my emergency tech nerd kit. It's filled with USB ports, power supplies. Like, it's got everything that I could reasonably need in, like, an audiovisual multimedia kind of situation. And I did that mainly because of my convention experience. But go ahead.
Well, there's also an issue with that, in that Dunning-Kruger effect might appear, that people will think that, oh, they know exactly what to do. They know how to set this stuff up. And then they get to start setting stuff up and they mess up the entire con's audio equipment or something, thinking that they knew more than they actually do. So I'd caution to lower your expectations of yourself when it comes to technical experience, and try and rely more on the con staff when it comes to messing with any of the equipment.
Low tech.
Pen
and paper. We didn't even have like tablets for people to fill out stuff. Like, there was no video or projector. So
that's a great idea.
Just go in without anything you need to hook up, except maybe like your USB port to charge your phone. Like, I would not go in with some grand light show and multimedia sound shenanigans.
And unless you're dealing with the bronies, expect to lose most of your pens.
Yeah, the first bring back the pens.
Yeah, so the bronies.
I love that that's the takeaway there.
Yeah, bulk buy pens.
Yeah. You're going to need a lot. You're going to need at least a pen per survey, and expect to not get it back. Like, I mean, like, just little things you don't think about. One of the things that I was thinking about, what you were talking about, Andrew, was that it's, I think, very difficult your first time going to the conference, if you're going to collect some data, if you're going to try to get involved in some way, unless you have previous research or some experience. But I find it helps even more when you can, like you mentioned, offer something to the conference. So one of the things that we've done every year we've gone to the Brony conventions is that we apply to panels.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, hey, we'll give a panel, we'll talk about our research. And much unlike the video that we created for this, for Southwest Psychology Association, and that I've done in years past, where like 10 people show up and half of them are for the next person. These are like standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to a fan convention and talk about, fans are interested and what you have to say about them. They may not always be happy, but they are at least interested in people taking an interest in their group. They want to talk about their community. They want to hear what you have to say, and they want to ask you questions. And that's one of the things that we even promoted, is just an ask a fan psychologist panel. As something to give back to the convention. We know that the room's going to fill up, at least with Brian. And people will
Akon's pretty good about us getting full rooms.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. You don't feel like a standard conference-going psychologist when you go to one of these things.
That
some of Steven and Courtney's panels at Anime and Furry. Huge. And I think one of the things that really builds a rapport with the fandom is that they always do like a Q&A after, where they like ask the participants of the study that they're talking about,
right,
what do you think, what should we study next, here, take a survey, this is going to be next year's presentation. And so there's kind of that continuous relationship that you build. So it is a lot harder to do it the first time, because nobody knows who you are, you're a shrink with a pen and paper, like, highly suspicious.
And you can get around some of that too, because whether you're talking about a for-profit or a non-profit convention, most dealers' room tables are going to cost money. And so you might have to put that money up front that first year so that you get a spot. Mm-hmm. Instead of asking for space, say, look, you know, or you can ask. It doesn't hurt to ask.
I mean,
but I
don't think we've been told no yet. They either don't respond or they emphatically say yes.
Yeah, Yeah. Though the last Bernie convention we went to, we shared space with someone who was already like doing the paper. And so it just kind of worked out. And when we told them that we were going to do this, they gave us a table that was kind of like right in the middle of like a high traffic area. And so
it's good of them.
And I mean, we've done that with, we did that when we went to Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I sent them an email and asked them, they said, we'll waive the cost. And they literally stuck us on the end, like at one of the most high traffic points.
Yeah, if you were going to go shopping at that festival, you had to walk by our booth.
Yeah. And I mean, we still only got like 50 people, but hey, it was.
We had some cool conversations about aliens, though.
We really did.
Yeah. One of the. A thought that occurred to me, like one of the things that is important is kind of where they put you in the convention, because that will also kind of tell you how happy they're actually to have you there. Like, nope. Don't get me wrong, they're like, you're there, you're a potential draw for people, like they're happy to have you, but based on kind of like where they want to put you, you can kind of get an idea of how open to research they're actually going to be. And this isn't to say, like, if they put you, like, in the nosebleed section or something, that, like, you should just give up. That's a good start. Like, you're in the door, do your thing, and maybe, you know, you'll get a table with two chairs instead of one. But it is... There's a lot of things that go on in planning an event of the size of a convention, whether that be a small local one that tops like maybe 100 or something, to one that tops, you know, tens of thousands. I think at the time I've been doing the ACON stuff, like 25, 26,000 people. And, you know, I think as a researcher, I was really surprised when we had the first conference and we had situations where we had to turn people away for certain panels. And that was something that really made me realize, like, not only is research at a convention viable, it is something that is desired, because like you guys were saying earlier, like, people want to know about themselves. They want to know about themselves, the community they're a part of, and science / scientists can sometimes provide that. And so it really just ignites a need in people. And, like, one of the benefits of doing fan research, I would say, is that on occasion you'll get someone who then becomes a researcher themselves. And a person who was just like, I'm here to watch anime and talk about anime. And then they find themselves in a panel discussing, you know, Machiavellianism in, what was that one on? Code Geass, you know, they'll be like, oh, I can do research like this. Mm-hmm. Oh, people will come and listen to me talk for 30 minutes about this and then ask questions. So as far as like a good of doing fans conference research is, I think it inadvertently brings people into science and makes it much more friendly. So that's also a way you can sell it to a convention, is it's going to increase interest, I would say 90% of the time.
So I'm going to transition, because you mentioned Machiavellianism, which is one of the dark triads. And we've been pretty positive so far. I figured it's probably not a bad idea to talk about some of the negative. Because not everyone is, and again, fan conferences aside, the people who run the conferences, in my experience, tend to be very open.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be very, you know, because again, if you publish a paper on it, you have to mention where you're getting your participants from. They're getting free advertising to like the two people who read that article.
Oh, come on. It's at least four and you know it.
That's true. So.
And it's everyone on this call.
Yeah. So the flip side of this is that while people running these conferences and festivals and get-togethers can be very open. People who run websites, so, you know, again, I can use, the bronies are really an outlier with this. I messaged mods. I got responses back within the next day. One of them said, my only suggestion would be just submit it on Thursday, because that's when we have, like, text-only,
meeting.
You know, text-only posts on our subreddit. And so that's when you're going to get the most traffic. And I was like, that's fantastic. You know, you guys are great. But on the other hand, you have mods and organizers who have been burned. I've run into that experience when trying to collect some data for this UFO or your UAP enthusiast survey. I had to send pictures of myself with my university ID to prove that I was a real researcher, because apparently they had gotten burned. One of the subreddits got burned by someone who claimed to be a researcher in the past. But they were really helpful. However, that was a community that was not expecting, because while some people were very open, I got some interesting emails. But I think...
Careful.
I think that... I don't think I've gotten anywhere near... I've been pretty spoiled when it comes to my research, as some of you guys have. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
To speak to the verification of identity, if you're going to work on Reddit, like, I've had people ask me for Stevens, my advisor's info, and they sent him an email that he then had to confirm that he was a researcher and that I was the grad student. So they were very suspicious. Do what now? Yeah, so be prepared to disclose some.
I've gotten that a few times.
Personal,
I've gotten that a few times.
Identification myself. Information to a bunch of anonymous people on Reddit. If you want to,
I mean, even if it's just
conduct research,
even if it's just your affiliation, but like some of that, I mean, depending on what you give them, I've been signed up for spam email. That's probably the worst. It's that's probably the most annoying. I can deal with like an angry, you know, RI am very smart kind of response about how my research is worthless and
keyboard warriors. Love them.
Yeah, I should stop while I'm ahead. I can deal with that. It's just having to like filter spam messages is far more of an inconvenience.
Yeah. I would say before, because I am going to pass the torch on to Adam, but I will say that if you're interested in audience member, if you're interested in doing research on Reddit, I've gotten some great participant polls. We've had some great interactions. It's a great place to recruit. But it does come with some risk. And typically, so I'm about to go through a Reddit venture starting in the fall with my honors student. So fingers crossed for me for that. But they were like, so are we going to open the survey up all semester? And I was like, your mental health can't take that. We're doing it for 2 weeks. Max, maybe only a week, because you can get harassed and bullied and all sorts of things. And I think the worst. Oh, I think that's Appa.
That wasn't Ryza.
Pretty sure it did.
But I think because I've gotten some stuff, you know, just you know, your research is trash, your hypothesis is terrible. I get the occasional like smartass who wants to go on and like figure out what my hypothesis is and post it into the comment section so everybody reads it before they take the survey, which is terrible. I think the brunt of the harassment has been borne by Adam here. So kind of walk us through what happened to you, just to kind of give an idea of like the top end of abuse that you'll receive on Reddit.
The worst case scenario?
Yeah.
So there are some positives to doing online research, stuff like you can get more people and get a wider range of people. And there's a bunch of different communities that are specialized. They're specifically for different communities. So I've personally found that the gaming community is one of the most toxic communities for research. On the other end of the spectrum, though, I found that places like Our Data is Beautiful and Fuck Yes Science and a couple of those other communities are extremely helpful and
really
positive. I've got really most of the positive experiences from them. But it also depends on how you set up your surveys and how people can figure out how to finagle it. So one of the lesser annoyances that I had happen a couple of years ago with Dr. Frank was with a gaming community and a hobby community. We set up our survey, but we did not set it up so that people had to go through and mark each answer. So people would just skip through, and I got like 400 participants, and all I got was the demographic information, because people would just skip through to try and get that $50 Amazon gift card. And so, yeah, and so you can get lots of useless data from people that are just trying to get the, and they might try and do it more than once. So you might just get the same participant over and over five or six times. So that is one of the issues with online survey taking is, since it's anonymous, people don't feel the consequences of their actions nearly as much as if it's in person. People can be a lot more, have a lot more vitriol and can show off their hatred towards others a lot easier than in person. So one person in particular stands out.
Why wouldn't it?
Done anything else and added 69 at the end of it, I would have been like, yeah, that's a Redditor.
So a couple years ago, Dr. Frank, I set up this survey with like 10 or 12 different communities, like Data is Beautiful, Fuck Yeah Science, a few different gaming communities on Reddit, and a couple like crochet and knitting communities. Like, I was trying to get a large sample. And this Big Zicky guy came to each and every single one of the threads that I posted on, and he posted like five or six paragraphs of how I'm trash, the survey is trash, it's a terrible survey. And he sent me a good dozen or so messages before the automatic Reddit blocking thing blocked him from sending more private messages, because it was like every 5 or 10 minutes he would send me another message. And so this guy stalked me, harassed me, and I ended up trying to get him blocked from my threads and muted, at least, so that he couldn't post on the threads. And some communities were very helpful with that. Others were like, fuck it, you're on your own.
Was this like hobby pasta stuff?
It also depends on the community you're trying to
sitting there
get information from.
For minutes upon minutes formulating the stuff that he's typing out.
So the private messages were all very different, but they were all kind of in the same vein of, I hate you, you should die, just kill yourself type of stuff. And the other, the thread comments were, I would say three different variants or so, but they were all multi-paragraph. So it was, he spent a lot of time on it. And I don't know why he had so much hatred towards psychology and me in specific. Specifically, so you might run into those people. My suggestion for that is to try and have a thick skin, try and let it roll off your shoulders. Understand that there are some very motivated and not very nice people out there that will try and ruin your day just for their walls.
Especially if they happen to come across you. But these are, for the most part, insecure people in some fashion, who are using you as that punching bag. They're doing it because it makes them feel something or feel better about themselves by bringing you down. And as much as it seems personal, in the end, it's not. Like, you're just the next target.
Yeah.
There's going to be someone else. If it wasn't you, it would be someone else.
Well, and also
Adam's situation definitely was that. But sometimes you just get people who, you know, click on your link and just have some apathetic disregard. Just like, yeah, we're just going to write on their day. And, you know, your whole life is wrapped up in that 2 week of data collection, but their experience on that specific page asking you to take their survey is literally 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So there is a difference in perception of the engagement too.
Yeah.
And the, you know, amount, like, they're not going to a bunch of different survey pages to do that, but you have, like, 30 or 40 people who are all doing it to your survey page.
Yeah. It is important to know with Reddit, and this is kind of an interesting thing, because, I mean, most of the people who take your survey are not people who are going to be posting on Reddit regularly. Mm-hmm. We actually find that it's a very small minority of people on Reddit actually do post. I mean, this is Reddit's data itself. It's something like 10. Maybe less percent of all Redditors have ever made a single post, and very like, and then only slightly more than that actually engage in some way. And so the vast majority of people on Reddit are not posting, and not even like upvoting. They're just lurking.
Yep. Yeah. So they'll still click on your link.
Yep.
But also,
they'll probably even give you good data.
Do what now?
They'll probably even give you good data.
Oh yeah. I mean, I click on survey links all the time on Reddit, and I don't have voter comment. But I will say that the lurkers, like, when you do get that harasser in your comment section, the lurkers are going to read that comment section. So you want to make sure you maintain professionability, be cordial, like, don't give the lurkers any reason to distrust you or the research that you're doing if you go in super defensive in response to a troll. So, like, maintain face, like, you are on the job in that moment online, and you're definitely not anonymous.
Well, and that's definitely an important thing to keep in mind, is that the internet is a little bit of a mob mentality sometimes. So when you are dealing with that person, you know, sometimes it's a little bit like the bystander effect. Eventually, like, that troll will push a little bit too hard in certain communities, and I think your experience kind of dovetails with this, Adam, because, you know, on your hand, you had some communities where the mods stepped in and helped you out, but, like, I've seen comment threads where someone's getting harassed, and, like, after enough time, like, the people who don't normally speak start showing up, and they're like, okay, this is enough. You know, this person is just trying to do this thing. You know, if you spend 5 minutes Googling them, you'll see they're legit. Just go away. You know?
So I'm kind of the optimist of the group, and I think that there's good in everyone. But when it comes to online, I found that people like to dogpile. And so while you do get sometimes those people sticking up for you, in several of the comment threads, people would just go and add on to the Big Zicky's comment and say how terrible it was. Different aspects of the survey were trash, stuff like that. So you can't get that mob mentality to where people will jump on. It depends again on the community, I think. So the gaming community in general was not the best. It was very toxic. Compared to the other ones.
Didn't post enough memes.
Yeah, maybe that was it.
Oh my God, we should come up with a research meme for our recruitments. Embrace it, Daniel.
I mean, I'll embrace memes, but I don't need to overlap my research with. I mean, unless we want to do research on memes, like what meme brings the most people in, what meme turns people off.
I mean, I do research mainly just to see if I can get people to agree with an idea, so I'm down for this.
I mean, I guess technically in its basis sense, we're transmitting social information, so all research is memes.
Are we memes?
You're talking yourself into it, Daniel.
This podcast is memes, yeah. This podcast is memes. And the true Dawkinsian sense.
Ah, Dawkins.
So,
before I forget, one major piece of advice would be whenever you're creating your username for the Reddit community, make sure that it doesn't have your school in it, because they will oftentimes take down the account very quickly. So I don't have any of the messages from Big Zicky anymore that I could pull up and show, because Tamuzi took down the account. So make sure that you have like maybe your last name and psych research as your username or something.
I would make an argument that you shouldn't even have your last name in it, but like you're probably gonna have to identify yourself.
The recruitment letter is already gonna have your school.
Right.
I would create a Reddit account if I were gonna do Reddit. I tend to use the one like my standard account. But also like I always recommend create a free Gmail account, name it after whatever research study you're doing it on, so that when someone signs you up inevitably for spam, you can just can that account at the end and not have to worry about it anymore. I'm gonna have to do that now.
It's funny how many of the things we have to do on research online to like protect ourselves with like, you know, usernames and stuff like that, like it almost feels like you're trying to do something wrong, you know? Like, it's weird.
It's really just to kind of put a buffer between, like, your personal email stuff. Because I would heavily recommend you don't use that. You don't use your personal email. Though, I mean, sometimes you have to use a university email account in the cover letter. But I would rather them get that when they click the link, as opposed to getting it on the Reddit page.
Right.
Right.
I will generally put, like, our research email, so like bronystudyresearch@gmail.com, that's it. I'll put that there if they want to contact me, and I usually ask people, like, if you have a question about the survey or if there's something you're unsure about, contact me directly. Don't necessarily put it in the as a response or a reply. And usually it depends on the community, people are pretty good about it, and some communities are exceptionally well. I mean, the UFO communities that I went and collected data from, I was a temporary mod for like a month and a half in those communities, so that like I could go and delete a post, or if like there was an issue, like, I mean, I never really did anything with that, but
that was a big hit.
It was a really nice gesture on their part. I highly recommend, there's some fascinating communities to get involved in.
Oh yeah. I think the big takeaway is make sure you introduce yourself to the mods, get the mod permission before you upload your survey.
Oh, definitely.
You know, make sure that you do all of the formal, so like going to a conference, talk to the people in charge first. You are going to have a tough time. If you're in person, it's going to be physically exhausting, and you're going to be talking to lots and lots and lots of people for a long, long time, for several days. And if you do it online, you're going to have 2 weeks of just neurotic hell while you wait as you get emails saying so-and-so commented on your post. And you're like, oh no, what fresh hell is this? So
it's like that famous Reddit challenge, the thread 50-50.
Right? Yep.
Oh, yeah.
You never know what you're
going to get. Yeah, it's either puppies or something you'd rather not see.
Yep.
Well, I guess we've given a fair bit of advice.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've at least touched upon, you know, hit our marks. So I guess we should conclude with our bias of the week. And Andrew said that his favorite bias is confirmation bias, so that's the one we're going to do this week. We're going to put him on the spot. But it's the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms or supports one's prior belief or value. So I'm going to figure it also is very apt. We are talking about Reddit. Mm-hmm. So it's just a huge dig at everyone on Reddit. A lot of confirmation
that
is going on. Well, social media in general,
the algorithm
feeds confirmation bias.
Well, I mean, if anyone on the internet is too upset with us, you know, they can just find me on Mario Kart and I'll 1v1 them. I'll assert my dominance that way.
And that's a way to help prove that you're better by only 1v1ing them in Mario Kart and not something else. I don't know.
Harassing him on.
Not harassing him on.
Yeah. I think one thing I would caution, particularly with confirmation bias, and this is for the researchers who consider themselves avid fans and researchers who want to go in and pathologize fans, is that you're going to find what you're looking for when it comes to fan research. We will talk more about this in a later podcast, probably at the end of the summer, but I'm currently dealing with a large confirmation bias issue in a replication study at the moment. Both sides found exactly what they were looking for, and I find that meta interesting that I would like to talk about later. But just, go in and just, put on your research goggles as best as you can. Like, it is a conference, it is fun, but also it is your lab for the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, these individuals, too, you get enough people. You've got 25,000 fans in an area. You've got a Reddit with 50,000 members, a subreddit with 50,000 members. You take a large enough group of people, you're going to find the fascists. You're going to find the super pro-social positive individuals in the group.
You're going to find a fascist. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I can't let that one slide without laughing, man. You're 100% right.
Yeah, you give me a large enough group of fans, I'll help you pinpoint the highly Machiavellian, the highly, narcissistic, the alt-right members of your fan community. I can do a survey on that. It'll be anonymous, unfortunately, for you, but they're there. Just by sheer numbers, they're there. But that's the thing. If that's all I was interested in, is pinpointing that negative aspect of fandom, I could find a handful of people that would help me confirm that, and I could write a qualitative research study basically ripping this fandom apart for being terrible. On the other hand, if I want to talk about the positive, I can find the people who are donating to charity and the nonprofits that have spurned out of the fan community, and I can just show that. Instead, we need to take a little bit more of a balanced approach. Maybe not go into it with this, like, we're definitely looking for this. There's something that made me think of this. I was reading an article about the introductions to articles and how a lot of psych articles nowadays will start with things like, this is, it's different from saying this is limited in scope in a lot of the research, but this research hasn't been done before. And someone's like, yes, it has. You will find enough studies to say that, no, this actually is something that's being looked at to some degree, not completely. And the whole article is about watching what you say, because if you're saying this has never been done or this is not being done enough, well, it turns out that it actually is. Maybe you're just not finding it, or maybe you're not pulling those articles. And so it made me really think about how to introduce.
Well, also sometimes that introduction should say, no one's ever done it before, should really be, no one's ever gotten this published before.
No, when you say that makes me think of the Great Terror of Rabazon. Information literacy.
Yeah. You need
to find those articles and get over your confirmation bias.
I mean, we will usually put things like the majority of research on fan communities within sport, because that is entirely true, or at least within psychology, is within sport. There's plenty of non-sport fan research outside of psychology. But also, I'm usually wording it as in a but not done by us. They're doing a lot of it and publishing it in the Phoenix papers.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and talking about our SWAPA presentation.
Yeah.
We usually get 20 people who listen to this, so that's 20 more people that listen to our SWAPA presentations.
Yeah.
So,
can I plug something for those 20 people?
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I work with the Fans Conference, which publishes the Phoenix Papers, which Daniel so generously just mentioned a moment ago. We have a website.
Hold on. Yeah, put a link.
Yeah, I'll send you guys a link and you can put that in there. But we publish from industry, from fans, from academics at all levels of the journey, whether that be undergraduate, graduate, postdoc, doctorate, whatever. But it's a great place to go and read articles about nerdy stuff that you're just not going to find anywhere else, because, you know, oftentimes a lot of this research isn't as valued in the biggest journals as it should be, in my opinion. So the Phoenix Papers is kind of a great resource.
Peer-reviewed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. We have an editing board. It's blind peer review. The board is made up of both academics and professionals.
Cool.
Yeah. And if you made it this far and thinking about doing research, or you do research in this field, give them a look. Submit something.
Yeah.
The link will be down in the description below.
Like and subscribe. Yeah. Smash that
Make
like
sure
button.
To ring that bell.
We don't post to YouTube anymore.
Oh, okay. So
we learned who the real fascists were.
Friends we made along the way.
Okay. Well, on that note, I'm gonna end. I'm gonna say goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.